Welcome to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We do not yet have a quorum, but we will start. We have several testifiers today to House File 945. Just to give you a little roadmap, we do have several testifiers, several dozen testifiers. So we are going to have to go quickly. We'll go in the order that is on the agenda so that if you see your name, if you wouldn't mind just moving up and just standing back by where the little rack of papers is as you come in, or finding a chair there so that you're right up, so we don't have to have we don't have to wait in between testifiers. We do have this room until midnight, so we will be working from 1 to 4, and then we can come back if necessary. We have a Ways and Means this evening, so it would be after that, after the conclusion of Ways and Means this evening, but it would be in this room. So, to begin, we have Commissioner Piper. Is she available? All right. Sue Abdeholden? There she is. And on deck we have Karen Rutley, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know there's a lot of people ready here to testify, but it's been tradition that we have a walkthrough, and we have noticed that there are some things in the bill that we haven't heard in committee or haven't had a hearing, and I'm wondering if we might be, what's your intent about overviewing the whole bill and what you've added or what you've changed from what we've heard? We know we have to change things to meet a budget target, but it's pretty hard to look through a bill this quick and this, that, and know what all those changes are.
Yeah, the intention, Representative Loeffler, is to go through a quick item change rundown when we start the markup of the bill tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but wouldn't the audience and us as members benefit from hearing that so that it might cause attention to someone in the audience who wasn't aware of something that got added that wasn't heard or something was changed so they could adjust their testimony appropriately?
Yeah, I think fair point, Representative Loeffler. We had posted the bill yesterday morning, I believe, at 10 a.m. To try to give folks enough time. The bills have, by and large, with a few exceptions, been in this committee or several other committees, so there's very little new territory. So I think what we will probably benefit the most from is public testimony before the bill is actually brought up. So that's the intention. Ms. Abdeholden, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member Sue Abdeholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and with the last name of AB, I'm glad that I'm first. As you know, our mental health system is under construction. We have a foundation, we know what works, but we haven't finished building it, and there are many unmet needs in our state. Thanks to the funding that is included in this bill, NAMI Minnesota believes that we can move forward in building a system that meets the needs of children and adults with mental illnesses because we have paid attention to key issues. We paid attention to early intervention by increasing funding for school-linked mental health grants. We estimate that another 3,000 children per year will be able to access treatment with the funding in this bill. We paid attention to the importance of not waiting until a mental illness hits stage four by increasing funding for first episode programs so we can prevent more young adults with schizophrenia from becoming disabled. We paid attention to the core services of our mental health system, supportive housing, ACT teams, respite care, and crisis services, by increasing funding for these important and effective programs. And we paid attention to the fact that in order to build our system, we need more mental health professionals by including funding to expand clinical training. NAMI greatly appreciates the fact that you paid attention to the many issues that the mental health community has brought before you. We also appreciate your funding new options such as ITV for targeted case management, looking at new intensive options for children with mental illnesses while funding the loss of the federal match for 700 residential treatment beds. And we appreciate the funding for the mental health innovation grants so that we can develop programs that look at the front and back door for hospitalizations for people with a mental illness. NAMI also appreciates the funding you've included for youth aging out of the foster care system. 26 is the new 18, and for these youth in particular, they need support beyond the age of 18. And And lastly, thank you for funding Text for Life. There are a lot of valid needs that have come before this committee, and we know you had difficult decisions to make, but thank you for proposing these important investments in our mental health system.
Right on the money. Thank you, Sue. Appreciate that. Next up, we have Kurt Rutzen from the ARC. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hello, Representative Dean, Chair, and committee members. My name is Kurt Watson with the ARC of Minnesota. First of all, I'd like to thank you for supporting the new employment services that you have in your bill that will help many, many, many people. I thank you for that. And second, I would like to ask all you guys to find a way to fix this bend down. Please don't ask me, but please find a way. We need to fix this bend down. That's very critical. I mean, we just need to do that, Chairman. And lastly, I would like to say we can continue to kick the can down the road. We can kick it all we want, but until we look beyond our own noses to the needs to others, we will get nothing done. And please do not kick the can down the road any longer, because the cans get far enough. We should stop it right now in here and fund these programs for the disabled people, and we just need to do that. It's the right thing to do. I thank you for your time, and thanks so much.
Thanks for your testimony and for your advocacy, Mr. Rutzen. Which commissioner? Commissioner Piper is here. All right. Welcome to the committee. There she is. Didn't see you there, sorry. I think, yeah, that was applause for Kurt. All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Emily Piper. I'm Commissioner of Human Services for the state of Minnesota. And thank you for having me here today and for the opportunity to speak to the bill before your committee. And I believe there is a letter that will be shortly or was passed out from me regarding the House bill. And this is the second omnibus HHS bill that I've been asked to speak on this morning, or today, and earlier this morning I had the opportunity to talk to our Senate Finance Committee. And in anticipation of that hearing and this hearing, I've been reflecting a lot on the bills and what's in them and what's not in them in the past day or so. And as I said this morning, every morning I open up the paper and I read about all the challenges that face us in our state. And it could be a story about a child who's been abused by a caregiver or a parent, a person with a disability who can't access services that they need, people on hold too long because they're trying to get a health care question answered, a sex offender who commits a heinous crime against the victim, a person who's attempting to jump off a bridge because their mental illness or chemical dependency has consumed them, an audit with a finding showing inadequate controls over taxpayer money, a person who's been found incompetent to stand trial for murder, the murder that they committed, and the list goes on. And I read about these stories with the same frustration, sadness, and anger as people all across the state do. But in my job, The first thoughts that come to my mind as I read each one of these stories are about all the ways that I, in the system I oversee, are responsible for making sure that we have done everything we can to avoid these situations from becoming tragedies, and when they are, preventing them from happening again. And that's what the people of Minnesota expect from us. That's what the governor expects from us. That's what the legislature expects from us, and in particular, what this committee expects from us. Over the last year and a half, my agency leadership and I have been directly held to account for outcomes that have not met the expectations of this committee. These hearings have included legislative audit findings, safe staffing for our facilities, and among others. I've focused much effort and attention to making improvements to our facilities, to the areas of greatest compliance and operations concerns, with some success. But DHS can only live up to those expectations and be held to account if we've also been appropriated the tools we need at the county, state, and federal levels to meet the needs that exist. Given this responsibility and the accountability I feel to deliver on the expectations of Minnesotans and the expectations I have for myself and my staff, I'm very concerned about the bill before this committee. This bill does not provide my agency or our partners with the tools our system needs to work, to do the work that the people of Minnesota, the legislature, and the governor have charged us with performing. And so I just would like to take a few moments to highlight a few of the most significant challenges with this bill. First, and the largest issue for me and our workforce, is the lack of operating adjustment funding to maintain the workforce we have. The total impact of this is over 300 full-time employee equivalents in DHS, including 210 full-time equivalents in direct care and treatment. This is a reduction in direct care and treatment alone that is equivalent to $35 million. And just for some context, the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center annual operating budget is $45 million, and this is a reduction of over 77% of that. The proposed operating adjustment funding is critical to ensure that we have services, that we have the services available to provide to the most vulnerable Minnesotans in our state. I also want to note that other investments that are in your bill, such as funding for the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services and Deaf and Hard Hearing Services, would likely be unachievable given this level of operating reduction across our agency. Second, the House bill fails to include other critical direct care and treatment items from the governor's budget to ensure safety for our clients and staff and the financial stability of our programs, including funding for the Minnesota State-Operated Community Services Program, which serves over 400 Minnesotans with developmental disabilities in 120 homes across the state. This funding is needed to provide long-term financial stability for this program. Additionally, the Minnesota Security Hospital staffing investment is critical to DHS's need to improve safety for our clients and staff and assure quality, clinically sound care. We have worked with staff at the Minnesota Security Hospital, legislators, stakeholders, union leadership, and many others for nearly 2 years to bring this proposal forward for the second time, and we need your support. Third, the bill before this committee does not bring our daycare assistance program into compliance with federal requirements and does not expand access to affordable child care for the working poor in our state. Unfortunately, the bill does not include funding to make it easier for families to receive assistance, update rates paid to child care providers, support working parents, implement needed integrity measures, and ensure that children are safe. This puts the state of Minnesota in further risk of penalties from the federal government for not complying with these requirements to make the program actually work better for families. Fourth, the bill does not keep Minnesota on a path to be a nation leader in health care. Rather, it has the potential to set us back as a state. The governor included a Minnesota Care buy-in option and also a repeal of the sunset tax, a repeal of the sunset of the provider tax as part of his budget. These proposals would help ensure the future financial stability of the healthcare system in the state of Minnesota, and neither of these proposals are included in your bill, as well as many federal compliance proposals that are also not funded. The bill does not include dental changes to ensure that more people on medical assistance, particularly children, receive access to dental care, even though there were savings as part of the governor's proposal to reform dental. I'm very concerned that the House bill removes medical assistance inflation from the forecast without including a mechanism to reduce spending by this amount in the language. This would negatively impact providers and also the people we serve. And also, as the governor noted in his letter to House and Senate leadership, I need information on what budget reductions you want us to make and what programs and services we should cut to achieve this reduction. Fourth, I'm disappointed the governor's proposed reforms to tackle significant workforce shortage issues impacting thousands of Minnesotans were not included in this bill, including rate increases to some of the lowest wage PCA direct care workers and the governor's self-directed workforce initiative in home and community-based services. You've heard a lot of testimony in committee that spoke to the hardships both on individual providers and the recipients of services that they face, yet this was not included in your bill. Fifth, the House bill did not include any funding for child protection, foster care, or permanency programs. We've worked together on the Child Protection Task Force, and I was hopeful you would include these important investments for children and families in your bill. By not funding these investments, particularly children under six will continue to wait longer than necessary for a permanent home and will be limited in the support we can provide to counties. Sixth, the House bill did not include any funding to ensure we have the tools we need to make our IT more secure and to work better for the people we serve in counties and other partners. I'm disappointed that there is not funding to maximize the federal revenue that is available now to ensure that our systems can continue to serve providers, counties, tribes, and individuals who depend on them. In addition to what's not in the bill before the committee, there are a number of additional items proposed in your bill that are problematic for my agency and the people we serve. First, the Hospital and Managed Care Organization Outcomes Program. The House proposal requires us to purchase a set of software that is duplicative of our efforts to improve outcomes for enrollees. There is no mechanism in place as a result of this bill to actually create savings. We agree with improving outcomes for our clients and are working really hard to do that, but the savings track for this in this proposal will not be realized. Healthcare Delivery Systems Pilot Project. The proposal includes over $144 million per biennium in savings for a program very similar to our integrated health partnerships. This bill was never heard to my knowledge in committee, and we do not see how the savings will be realized. Overall, this would likely lead to many people being disenrolled from medical assistance and losing their healthcare coverage. In addition, this includes a withhold of 2% of MCO capitation payments, which may prohibit DHS from getting actuarially certified rates and operating a managed care program. The implementation of eligibility verification and MA audit activities. This proposal includes $170 million in MA savings with an assumption of actionable audit findings. DHS completed a fiscal note for this bill, and we articulated that no savings could be booked. This is really serious, great concern for me. We have competitive bidding reform. The House bill includes $50 million in each biennium in new savings related to unspecified competitive bidding reforms. We have worked really hard in recent years to realize savings in this area and have been successful working together. DHS wasn't asked to work with you on this, and we didn't provide a fiscal note, and we have significant concerns about the underlying policy. We also believe that there will be costs related to this based on our recent discussions with our actuaries, and we can follow up with a more specific letter on this soon. We have the contingent rate reduction. This provision requires DHS to reduce MA provider rates if the $204 million in savings from competitive bidding reform, healthcare delivery pilots, and hospital outcomes program savings is not achieved. As highlighted in the governor's proposal regarding the access monitoring plan, we're required to monitor access to services when medical assistance rates are decreased or restructured. If medical assistance enrollees' access to care is adversely impacted by this decrease, CMS may not approve the changes in rates or may require a corrective action plan for the state to increase rates in the future, both of which could impact our federal funding relating to these services. With this rate reduction, I'm concerned that we will negatively impact our enrollees and providers and put in jeopardy our health care system we've worked really hard to build for Minnesotans. We have Minnesota Care Premiums. This proposal increases premiums on 86,000 low-income Minnesotans enrolled in Minnesota Care. as the House is considering tax reductions for many Minnesotans, including the wealthiest people in our state, I find it disturbing that included in this bill is a premium increase for some of our lowest income Minnesotans. We have managed care payment delay. In our current legislation, we have three shifts related to managed care payments. The House bill continues one of these payment shifts, which was implemented during deficit years. Doing this now undermines our managed care purchasing strategy that we've all worked really hard on in recent years, and it brings real concerns for me as we continue to try and negotiate our health care contracts. We have DHS technology and operations for MnSure. The House bill removes over $40 million per biennium from the DHS budget, which is currently allocated to MnSure for IT and business operations. This includes $3 million a year for navigator incentives and funding for many supports, including call centers, provider resources, and other services that support public program clients. These programs will be needed for DHS to continue to serve the over 1 million Minnesotans we do every day who are enrolled in our public health care programs. The establishment of the federally facilitated marketplace. This proposal would undo years of systems and operations work that we've undertaken to get us to a one-stop place for people in Minnesota who need health care. This will likely cause delays and gaps in coverage for people, and the fiscal tracking that is included in the House bill does not include the FTEs requested in the fiscal note for the additional work created to process FFM data, creating the shortfall for the healthcare administration administrative budget. The Children's Institute for Mental Disease funding, I very much appreciate the investment you've made in this area, but I also need to point out that this proposal overall does not support maximizing federal match and also does not facilitate needed reforms, which I believe we all want to do. I look forward to working together on this in conference committee. We have the legislative notice and approval for some waivers. This provision will dramatically slow down the process for HCBS waiver approvals and the implementation and could have many unintended consequences. I'm pleased to see there are a number of items in your bill that are also in the governor's budget, including phase two of the nursing facility VBR implementation, White Earth Nation Child Welfare Services, partial funding for our Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services program, expanding integrated health partnerships, investments in mental health infrastructure, substance use disorder reform, new employment services for people with disabilities, and implementation of the federal home health care rule. Many of the items and proposals in your bill have never had a fiscal note requested or do not reflect the proper funding or savings based on the fiscal note submitted. We've had over 300 fiscal notes assigned, and when the process doesn't reflect our best estimate as to costs and savings, that also is great concern to me and to our fiscal staff. As I said this morning in the Senate, I've been spending a lot of time looking at the reductions made in the 2011 shutdown. That was a difficult time for our state with a significant deficit, which forced us to make reductions to key programs. We're still trying to remedy issues caused by some of the reductions in 2011. During that time, we reduced adult mental health grants, made child care assistance program and other child care rate reductions, reduced general fund operating funds, and limited payment for some PCA care. We've worked hard together to get more funding for many of these items since 2011, and in a year where we have a large surplus in the state, I would hate to see us move backward again for the vulnerable people we're all here to serve. I hope that we can spend the next part of session working together to provide critical services to the people who need them. And I just want to close by saying thank you again for having me here today, and I look forward to working together over the rest of the session with you all moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner, for coming in today. We do appreciate your testimony, and also I just want to say thanks to you and all your staff who's been working with our staff on both sides and trying to put the bills together, and all of that hard work and all of the work of direct care and all your employees and staff. We do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We do have a quorum at 1:13. Representative Albright moves approval of the minutes for March 22nd, 2017. All those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The minutes are approved. All right. Next up, we have Steve Larson from the ARC.
Points coming up, Mr. Chair. Apologize for being late. Chair Cornish Kappas. Chair Cornish Kappas.
Next,
Commissioner is here. Mr. Chair.
Yep. Oh, Commissioner Ellinger is here? All right. Right on time. No, actually, Commissioner Ellinger was scheduled for 1:30, so I wasn't being snarky. Welcome, Commissioner Ellinger.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thanks for the person stepping aside to let me go ahead. I'm Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health, and I offer you my thanks as the committee for recognizing the important role that public health plays, public health at both the local level and at the state level through the Minnesota Department of Health, because it's really important for protecting and improving the health of all Minnesotans. As you know, a strong health system requires both prevention and treatment. While effective treatment is needed to address health problems when they arise, it's even better from a fiscal and health perspective to prevent problems from developing in the first place. And so focusing on prevention is the only rational long-term strategy for turning the curve on healthcare costs and improving the quality of life of Minnesotans. So I thank the committee for developing a bill that recognizes the importance of public health services and which invests more in public health. I also, though, ask you to consider adjusting aspects of the bill to focus resources on the highest priorities that have been articulated in the governor's budget, protecting vulnerable adults, giving at-risk children a healthy start in life, and preventing opioid use and addiction, especially for our American Indian communities. I will go over view some of the concerns that we have, some of the issues we have, but I'll also be following up with a letter that details more as after this hearing. So first, in the area of vulnerable adults, I appreciate the investment that you've made in the Office of Health Facilities Complaints, or OHFC, which plays a vital role in protecting our most vulnerable adults living in nursing homes and healthcare settings. This bill increases support for OHFC, but it funds just a quarter of the governor's revised March recommendations. While additional investment is helpful, investing less than the amount recommended by the governor would have serious ramifications for our most vulnerable adults, their families, and the community. OHFC has been working to streamline its processes, but the aging of our population and the tremendous increase in service demand far outpaces any gains that can be made just through process improvement. OHFC needs a more significant investment to achieve its performance goals, including doubling the number of investigations completed and increasing their timeliness, communicating swiftly and consistently with families about the status of those complaints, investigating lower-level allegations to prevent them from becoming more serious problems, and developing more efficient case management and IT systems. Related to family home visit, I also appreciate the committee's recognition of the importance of giving high-risk children a healthy start in life by increasing the MA reimbursement for public health nurse home visiting. While increasing the reimbursement rate would be a big help for some communities, more is needed to ensure that every corner of the state receives this vital service. For many children born to teen parents, the achievement gap starts at birth. Teen pregnancy and the need for evidence-based home visiting is a statewide challenge. 51% of teen births occur outside the seven-county metro area. Without funding the governor's request to expand home visiting for all teen births in the state, we would be unable to meet the need for our highest-risk children in many parts of the state. The third area is opioids. And again, this bill invests in strategies to prevent opioid use and addiction in Minnesota. We agree that the opioid crisis needs to be addressed and would encourage you to consider two proposals included in the governor's budget. The governor's revised budget incorporates a proposal built on Representative Baker's bill as amended in the Senate to create an ongoing source of funds to support opioid abuse prevention and treatment. And a second proposal specifically addresses the opioid crisis in the American Indian community by strengthening connections between tribal culture and the culture of health and reducing adverse childhood experiences for the American Indian youth population. Opioids among American Indians in Minnesota is the worst in the country, and so I think that focus on American Indians is really appropriate. Relating to the operating adjustment and fee proposals, I am very concerned that this bill does not fund the operating adjustment and fee proposals recommended by the governor. The cost of delivering effective governmental services grows each year, along with our economy and our population. While we make tough choices and continuously find new ways to do more with less, We cannot maintain the service levels Minnesotans expect without adjusting budgets to reflect the growing costs that all organizations face over time. Managing cost growth without an operating adjustment would require severe cutbacks that could lead to delays in reporting elevated blood lead levels in children for local agencies for follow-up to identify the source and make sure children receive appropriate care. It would decrease our ability to ensure that trauma care in rural hospitals meets minimum standards for rapid treatment for life-threatening injuries. It would reduce our capacity to establish health risk limits for groundwater contaminants, delay laboratory testing for things like rabies, measles, mumps, influenza, Zika, and lessen our ability to test for radiation in the environment near nuclear power plants. It would reduce our capacity for a safe harbor program for youth, for childhood victims of sexual exploitation. Again, it would be less funding for the Office of Health Facilities Complaints and for the licensing and certification of nursing homes. And it would basically give us overall less flexibility to respond to state-level priorities, emergencies, and sometimes to meet our federal match requirements. Related to fees, over time, the legislature has chosen to fund 34 public health programs through fees, reaching approximately $50 million in our budget, or 10% of our overall budget. By law, we are directed to bring forward proposals to set fees for those programs at a level that balances costs over time. If we commit to funding public health programs through fees, then we must commit to raising those fees periodically as costs rise. Without the governor's recommended fee changes, we cannot issue licenses and permits to investigate complaints in a timely fashion, which undermines the purpose of these programs, which is to ensure health practitioners meet state qualifications and standards, prevent contamination of drinking water and blood supplies, and ensure restaurants, pools, and lodging establishments are safe. At a time when federal funding for public health may be at risk, it is especially important to maintain the services supported by the general fund and fee programs. One of the areas that we're really proud of is our work on tobacco control and prevention through the SHIP program and in the quitline in the state. And sustaining the statewide safety net in the form of tobacco quitline is really important. It is one of those important activities that we must maintain. However, given the power of prevention, I'm disappointed to see that funding for the treatment service, even one as valuable as the quitline, comes at the expense of another service focusing on preventing health problems like tobacco use before they start. This program is known as the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership, or SHIP. It supports local schools, businesses, apartment owners, managers, farmers, community groups, senior organizations, hospitals, clinics, chambers of commerce, faith organizations, and many others in the community in creating opportunities for active living, healthy eating, and tobacco-free living. The results of this program have been quite dramatic throughout the state and has been one of the reasons we've been able to turn the curve on some of the greatest risk factors that affect chronic diseases. CHIP supports smoke-free spaces, including public housing, among many other strategies to prevent the harmful effects and high health care costs associated with tobacco use. The cut that we have for shifting this to the quitline equals nearly 10% of the program this biennium and nearly 17% ongoing, which would reduce technical assistance and grant dollars to community health boards and tribal nations throughout the state. We need both prevention and treatment. We cannot successfully do both by cutting one to feed the other. So it is vital to maintain the strong prevention programs in light of emerging tobacco products such as e-cigarettes, to which young folks are turning to in greater numbers. And Minnesota's history of directing tobacco settlement dollars into the general fund is a cautionary reminder that funding today's needs by shortcoming prevention is not a winning long-term strategy. Another area of concern is related to the radon repeal. And considering that radon is the leading cause of lung cancer among non-smokers, and the fact that Minnesota is among the states with the biggest radon challenges, I'm disappointed to see that this bill repeals the radon licensing program created in 2015. As we have shared in the past, radon is a major public health hazard in Minnesota. Nearly 40% of Minnesota homes have elevated levels of radon, and we see about 600 lung cancer deaths per year related to radon exposure. Minnesota receives regular complaints from the public about improper radon testing and mitigation work. In some cases, shoddy mitigation work actually makes radon risk worse. Licensing legitimizes the industry and adds credibility to the work done by professional staff trained in proper testing and mitigation. Without licensing, there would be lack of accountability, and the quality and consistency of work will suffer. That means increasing the risk to the public. people in greater Minnesota would be the least protected because they would lack the minimal protection offered by building inspection officials in the most populated areas of the state. In response to the concerns of the industry, we worked hard on revisions to the Raid on Licensing Act last year to reduce the licensing fee and address some other issues. The compromise was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. We don't think that it should be eliminated at this point. One area that we have been focusing on is network waiver appeals. I urge you also to fund a one-time cost of implementing the network waiver appeals process, including in the premium study bill enacted in January. The appeals provision was added late in the fast-paced process, so there was not an opportunity to address the fiscal impact. The governor revised the budget to include $411,000 one-time appropriation in fiscal year 2018 for costs related to the appeals, including attorney fees, administrative law judge fees, and legal expenses of the aggrieved provider if a network adequacy waiver is ultimately overturned. These costs would begin in fiscal year 2017 and conclude by 2019. So in closing, Minnesota is a healthy state, but we face some significant and growing health challenges. Governor Dayton's budget addressed these challenges in a strategic and effective way. This proposed investment benefits the health of Minnesotans today and into the future. So I appreciate that this budget makes some investments in public health, but these investments in this bill do not go far enough to address Minnesota's most pressing needs. I certainly pledge to continue working with you on a budget that addresses these needs and works to make common sense health reforms and smart public health investments to protect and enhance the quality of life for all Minnesotans. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Ellinger. I want to thank you for coming in today and also thank your staff for all the help. I've heard unsolicited good comments from folks who've been working with your staff to try to put the bill together. We do appreciate all the good work you do.
I'm blessed to be able to work with them and with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Steve Larson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Unless there's another commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think they've all testified. Sorry about that. First of all, I want to thank you for your including language in the bill and funding to lower parental fees by 25%. We've heard very dramatic testimony in this room in the past week or two about this, and this will help out thousands of Minnesota families. The Office of the Legislative Auditor cited a couple of areas that Minnesota needs to improve in, and they're nothing new. They were employment and housing. Our rates of integrated employment and housing are below national standards, and we need to improve in those areas. So I want to acknowledge the legislation that supports new employment services, as well as expanding the use of consumer-directed community supports. These two items in your bill will greatly help achieve the goals in employment and housing that we have for persons with disabilities. We have three areas of concern that we're very willing to work with you in the last 2 months of the legislative session to see if we can make success. First one is MSA housing assistance. It might have been overlooked, but there was a savings in this. We want to make sure that this is included in the House omnibus bill. As Kurt Rutson testified, we're greatly concerned about MA spend down, and we think we could still make progress during this legislative session in that particular area. And we're also interested in funding for the Best Life Alliance. Kurt gave a very eloquent speech about kicking the can down the road, and I just want to clarify, he was talking about the crisis that we have with direct support professionals. Persons with disabilities that the ARC advocates for are at great risk unless we really come up with 100 different solutions to meet the need here. CDCS legislation, employment legislation will help, but we ultimately need a rate increase. I sat at this table and testified last Thursday in the Tax Committee expressing concern that the $1.3 billion tax cut would probably make it very difficult to give a rate increase. And unfortunately, I was correct in that as far as this bill goes, but we still have 2 months, and like I said, we're very willing to work with you, work hard to see if we can get that rate increase in 2017. Thank you for your hard work, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Oh, we do appreciate your testimony. Next up, we have Cheryl Prate from ARM. Welcome to the committee. And just so testifiers know, The commissioners obviously had additional time, but we're going to try to keep testimony to 2 minutes, so we will try to keep things along so that as few people as possible have to come back. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Cheryl Prey. I'm CEO of ARM. And as the newly appointed CEO, I have not had the opportunity to testify in front of this committee, so I'm very happy to be here with you today. I'd like to acknowledge members of the committee for your collaborative spirit. You have clearly had difficult choices to make in all of the allocations of funds. And as we've heard from commissioners prior to my testimony, you've made difficult decisions on behalf of people with disabilities. But specifically, I'd really like to acknowledge your support of the DWS legislation. It's a real testament that you have acknowledged the challenges faced by providers who care for people with disabilities. Thank you for working with ARM and the DWS Coalition and including important changes to the DWS legislation and for preserving items previously put into legislation. There are several issues that you have included in this bill that will have a real positive impact on our providers and the people they serve. Most notably is addressing the therapeutic leave day issue for ICF services and increasing the residential asleep overnight staff wage to the minimum wage. We are in a time of change, and your continued support as we all work together to collaborate on creating new ways to integrate people with disabilities into the community. At the end of the day, that's what we all seek to achieve. So on behalf of ARM and all of the providers that I represent, thank you for your ongoing support, and I look forward to working with you through the rest of the session. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Bay. Next up, we have Rebecca Preston, citizen advocate. Welcome to the committee. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
Nice to see you again. Welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine.
Okay, I'm not very good with mics. My name is Rebecca Preston, and I'm here to express my extreme disappointment that this budget does not reflect a fund increase for the medical assistance spend-out limit. When I testified before and when I met with some of you, you all agreed that this is a bad policy. Yet, here I am again asking you to please fund even a small increase in the medical assistance spend-out. Raising it by 5% would cost less than $4 million a year. That would keep about $50 more in my pocket. And although that might not seem like a lot to all of you, for me it would mean I could buy healthier food than what I find at the food shop. Most importantly, after paying my spend down, I'm left with $792 a month to live on. After I pay my rent costs, I'm left with about $60 left for the whole month to live on. It's pretty difficult. Most importantly, this would give me hope that I can remain independent. I don't want to end up in a nursing home, and I don't want to end up in a brain injury. I would love to afford choices. The choice of what I eat, the choice of where I want to live, the choice of what I want to wear. But if that continues to live on $792 a month, that won't be possible. I paid into Social Security working two jobs before my brain injury. So continuing to take money out of my Social Security disability income from me is not the way to balance the Minnesota budget. Thank you for listening, but really I need you to do more than listen to me. Please fix the medical assistance spend down.
Thank you, Ms. Preston. We appreciate your testimony. Next up, we have Mary Regan from Aspire, Minnesota. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of Aspire, Minnesota. I am just here to say thank you, in particular for your investment in very vulnerable children. Thank you for including Representative Albright's bill that would fund residential treatment services for 700 youth on any given day in Minnesota. Thank you for including Representative Bennett's bills that would allow young people to age out of foster care without a viable family to return for support, as well as provide property insurance coverage for foster parents. Thank you for funding SchoolLink Mental Health and for first episode psychosis. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today. Next up, we have Cheryl Grathy from Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, and then we have Shauna Mulvihill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chairman Dean, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cheryl Grathy, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. We are a large group of organizations working together for policy change that positively supports people with disabilities. This year, we have 17 formal bills that we have vetted and are endorsing. Literally hundreds of people have spent thousands of hours assessing where the need is greatest, finding innovative ways to cut the costs, researching, learning, meeting with DHS, and constructing needed legislation. As a group, we have structured our priorities accordingly and have three bills in our top tier: the MA spend down, MSA housing supports, and CDCS reform. First, I'd like to thank you for supporting CDCS as well as lowering parental fees and the new employment services. These are all very important pieces of legislation that we are also endorsing. CDCS is one of our top three priorities, but our other top two priorities, the MA spend down and MSA housing supports, still need your support. Our top three priorities were chosen through a dedicated process, and we feel that these are the most needed areas of reform for the disability community. Our goal is to keep people living independently in the community, and your goal is to use the state's money wisely, allocating funds so that people can live in the community in the most cost-effective solution. Forcing people to live on $792 a month, which you've heard reference to now several times this morning or this afternoon, with the MA spend down is a recipe for failure and is landing more and more people in nursing homes or group homes at four times the cost of keeping them in the community with an increase to their spend down. We in the disability community have constructed legislation that is absolutely necessary and as cost effective as possible. Many of our bills have long-term built-in savings that don't show in the fiscal notes. Or like with the MSA housing supports, which Steve Larson mentioned might have been overlooked, there are built-in savings early on. We have stepped up to the job that you have asked us to do, and we have brought you the needs of the disability community, given our priorities and outlined the ways to meet those needs. Now we would like you to respond in kind by funding those needs. And thank you so much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Grassi, for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, Ms. Mulvihill. Next up, we have Lorna Schmidt.
My name is Shannon Mulvihill, Executive Director of Mental Health Minnesota. I want to express my thanks and appreciation for a number of increases to mental health services in this bill. First, thank you for the inclusion of the Mental Health Innovation Grants. We need more and better access to mental health services across the state, especially for those who that serve people who need help but may not require a hospital level of care. I believe that the funding will help us create more solutions to meet that need. Next, I greatly appreciate the increases to programs that promote early intervention, identification, and treatment for young people who struggle with mental illness, such as SchoolLink Mental Health and First Episode programs. Early treatment and intervention can be absolutely life-changing and is an incredibly important piece in building our mental health system. I also thank you for continuing to build out mental health crisis services, including Text for Life, which can get people the help they need quickly and often avoid hospital care, and also saves lives. Finally, thank you for your commitment to additional housing opportunities for those living with mental illness. It is nearly impossible to move toward recovery from a mental illness if you don't have a safe and stable place to live. And people living with a mental illness are already more likely to be homeless. This bill continues to make progress on ensuring that everyone has a place to call home. Your investment in these and other mental health programs and services helps make sure that recovery is possible and that people across the state have the resources they need to get there. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony today. Next up, Lauren Schmidt. Welcome to the committee. Ben Gustafson is on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lorna Schmidt. I'm the director of the local public health association. On behalf of our membership, I'd like to thank you for your ongoing investments to the local public health grant and the statewide health improvement partnership, also known as SHIP. We know many difficult decisions were made when putting this bill together, and we appreciate your efforts to protect these critical sources of public health funding. As you know, public health is on the front lines every day, performing core state-mandated services to protect and promote the health of our communities. The past funding cuts and emerging threats like infectious disease outbreaks, opioid abuse, and a growing mental health crisis have pushed the system to a breaking point, and local tax levies are currently carrying the burden. As you continue negotiations, we hope you'll continue to explore opportunities to reinvest in the local public health grant to restore capacity to meet state mandates, address local public health priorities, and relieve local levies. We appreciate that SHIP funds are kept nearly level in this bill, but note that there is a shift of some funding to offset the cost of a state tobacco quitline. We support establishing a permanent funding source for a quitline, but would be remiss if we didn't call attention to the fact that this transfer will mean less funding to local agencies and their community partners, which will have implications for the collaborative work needed to prevent tobacco use from occurring in the first place. Moving forward, we hope space can be found in the budget to invest in tobacco treatment without sacrificing local prevention efforts. Last but not least, we'd like to thank the committee for its support of family home visiting by investing in increasing MA reimbursements for evidence-based public health nurse home visits. This is a first step towards stabilizing these critical programs for at-risk families, but it shouldn't be the last. To maximize impact and ensure resources reach all counties and more families, we encourage you to expand this proposal to increase the rate for all public health nurse home visits, capturing both evidence-based and evidence-informed. The proposal to increase the rate for all home visits is also backed by the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Targeted Home Visiting Coalition, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and the State Community Health Services Advisory Committee. The difference in the fiscal note from expanding this proposal would have less than $700,000 to 2018 costs, approximately $1.8 million for the biennium, a relatively small price tag to ensure statewide reach. We'd be happy to continue discussing this option with you and appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Mr. Gustafson is up next. Laura Sales on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Dean and committee members, my name is Ben Gustafson. I work for Fraser, a nonprofit mental health care disability service provider and Minnesota's most experienced autism service provider. I'd first like to say thank you for continuing to work on the ongoing implementation of DWRS. DWRS is among the most critical issues of the session for our families. About one-third of individuals living in Fraser's homes will likely see their rates drop by more than 10% when fully implemented, and we're extremely concerned with what that will mean for the individuals we serve. On behalf of Fraser families and working families across the state, I want to thank you for your continued work reducing TEPRA fees. Also, thank you for expanding choice and options for people with disability by including the new employment services. We're also appreciative of your support for schooling's mental health and first episode intervention programs. Further, thank you for not including the 245D licensing fee increase. Lastly, I know the chair and committee members are acutely aware of the workforce shortages in mental health and home and community-based services. Please keep those shortages in mind as you move forward in this session. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We do appreciate it. Next up, we have Ms. Sales, and Barty Wally will be on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Representative Dean, members of the committee, my name is Laura Sales, and I'm with the Minnesota Nurses Association. And just a note that in the interest of time, this is not an exhaustive list of our thoughts on the bill. So for some of the things that we like the funding for the mental health programs, like the school-linked mental health grants, funding for programs that deal with the first episode of psychosis, the mental health innovations grants, and more. We also are happy about the MA reimbursement for evidence-based nurse home visiting program and the funding to protect vulnerable adults in healthcare settings. A few more things that we are encouraged by are the Palliative Care Advisory Council, the Senior Care Workforce Innovation Grants, and the Health Professional Loan Forgiveness Program. So Some of the things we have concerns about are some of the sources for the cuts or decreased spending in the bill. Taking inflation out of the state MA forecast seems to mean either cutting people off MA or decreasing benefits available to people, which seems a bit at odds with all the investments you've made in other programs like mental health funding. So we appreciate that you realize the need for these increased funding, but doing it at the expense of many health care programs doesn't seem to be quite square. The competitive bidding reform seems to be a rather arbitrary number that you're trying to achieve, especially if I've read the language right, with the contingent rate cut if certain savings are not achieved. Seems like you're just taking money out of the system rather than stimulating real reform. We're also concerned that there's no funding for increased staffing at Anoka and St. Peter. We made a lot of progress on staffing issues at those facilities with some funding last year, but there's still a lot of work to do to ensure patient and worker safety, which are issues that you heard some very compelling testimony on earlier in session. We're also disappointed that there's no repeal of the sunset of the provider tax, and the Minnesota Care buy-in is not included. Lastly, we would like to find out more about the healthcare delivery system reform proposal. I think it's the one that tracks $144 million a year in savings on the spreadsheet. And if it does, in fact, promote more direct care contracting, direct contracting and care coordination, we would be interested in digging into the minutiae of that proposal to understand how to achieve these savings. Thanks.
Thanks for your testimony today. We do appreciate it. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record. We got Rick Seiler on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Barchi Wahi, and I'm the Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund. First, I want to thank members for including additional funding for food shelf grants and for allowing funding to be used to purchase diapers. We appreciate that inclusion in the bill. For the rest of my remarks, I will focus on three policy areas that, with our commitment, can help move children and families forward. First of all, child care. We have appreciated the increased attention given to child care in this body and thank Representative Franzen for her leadership on this issue. We are deeply disappointed that given the growing recognition that child care is in crisis, that this budget does not include bipartisan proposals introduced this session that would serve more families through the child care assistance program and or update eroding provider reimbursement rates. Similarly, it does not include Representative Franzen's bipartisan proposal to align CCAP with the federal family-friendly child care guidelines that would bring greater stability to the lives of children, parents, and providers. Second of all, I'd like to speak to you about the Minnesota Family Investment Program. After 31 years without an increase, we are heartened by the expanding support on both sides of the aisle for raising the MFIP cash grant. We are disappointed that this budget does not include an increase. The current cash grant, even when combined with the food portion, leaves a family of three at about 58% of poverty. 71% of families accessing MFIP are children, and more than two-thirds of MFIP households have children under six. An MFIP cash grant is a children's issue, and we encourage you to think about it that way. As this committee knows, poverty is correlated with poor childhood and adult outcomes, and resulting in long-term costs both to the state and to our local communities. Finally, I'd like to talk to you about health care. Since the implementation of ACA, we've seen a 50% reduction in the number of uninsured Minnesota children. Uninsured rates for all Minnesotans have reached an all-time low, resulting in cost savings from uncompensated care, preventative care, and increased federal funding. Through Minnesota, we've created a one-stop-shop health care system and infrastructure that fits the needs of our state and our people. We are concerned that by moving to a federally facilitated exchange, as proposed in this bill, we would waste our financial, technology, and training investments and even put Minnesota Care in jeopardy. The long-term future of Minnesota Care seems uncertain in this bill. And in addition, in the near term, this budget would ask low-income Minnesotans to shoulder higher health care costs by raising the Minnesota Care premiums. We need to maintain and build on our health care gains, not move backwards. In conclusion, we hope to work with you to increase our collective commitments to our state's children and families through improvements to CCAP and MFIP and for the protection of our health care systems and to ensure access and coverage for all low-income Minnesotans. Thank you.
Next up, we have Rick Seiler.
Chairman Dean.
I'll give you a hand with the microphone. There you go.
There you go.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Rick Seiler. I'm testifying today to share my disappointment that the Omnibus Health and Human Service Bill includes no funding to increase the MA disability spend-down. As you may recall from my previous testimony, I suffered a traumatic brain injury after rescuing a girl from her car. I was slammed between two vehicles. As much as this changed my life, I've never regretted stopping to help her. Today I live independently by means of a caddy waiver, which requires me to have medical assistance. I spent 25 years working as a construction worker and paying into the Social Security system. Now when I need these benefits, I'm forced to pay $400 spend down, which leaves me short by the end of the month. As a former elected official, I know you have a tough decisions that you need to make. I'm not asking for any programs or any funding for myself. I'm asking you to let me keep more of my own Social Security money. Please find a way to fix the spend down. Thank you. And I'm done today.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Seiler. We appreciate you coming back. All right. Ron Elwood, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and thank you for indulging all of us and telling you what we like and what we don't like about the bill. First, we also want to express our disappointment that there's no increase to the MFIP grant. In 1986, it covered 100% of the rent. Today, it covers half. I'd like to thank Representative Pearson and all the co-authors on both sides of the aisle for bringing that increase forward. On child care, we also want to thank Representative Ross Peterson and Representative Franson for their leadership in chief authoring bills on child care assistance, but we have to express our disappointment as well that the CCAP reforms supporting parents trying to continue their education and supporting homeless families are not included in this bill. And finally, on health care, we're disappointed about the increase in the Medicare premiums. We're also very concerned about a number of the other provisions, including moving to a federally facilitated marketplace and its impact on the Navigator program and the Minnesota Care program, the legislative audit provision, and the managed care withhold that requires enrollees to submit a form to retain eligibility. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony today. Next up, we have Pam Ganella, Best Life Alliance. Welcome to the committee. And Mary Krenke is on deck, making her way down.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pam Ganella, and I'm the chair of the Best Life Alliance. I'm also the parent of an adult with disabilities. I'm asking you to support increased wages for direct care professionals that work in community-based services for people with disabilities. Direct care workers are the hands that provide the quality care that Minnesotans with disabilities rely on to live in their communities. I know you're facing difficult decisions on how to spend limited state dollars, but we are asking you to please support these critical services that allow Minnesotans with disabilities to live meaningful lives in the communities. Today, direct care staff wages in Minnesota are far below competitive wages in our economy. This has caused services across the state to face an enormous workforce shortage. If there's not enough staff to meet the health and safety needs of people with disabilities, our home and community care services will fall apart. My daughter, Sarah, loves the intermediate care facility where she lives with five other people with very severe disabilities. Right now, one half of the staff positions at her house are vacant. The only reason her house can continue to operate is that the nonprofit that runs it is begging their other staff that work in other houses to come and cover shifts at Sarah's house. And they have to be paid overtime wages. This is absolutely not sustainable. Providers are scaling back and even closing due to lack of staff. This is of great concern for parents like us. If Sarah's group home closes, where will she go? I am old and I can no longer care for her. I took care of her 25 years at home. and after 3 knee operations, I'm just not strong enough to care for her anymore. Just a few days ago, I was helping her on the stairs, and she leaned on me unexpectedly, and we both almost fell down the stairs. Parents and providers and people with disabilities really can't wait any longer. This is a we are asking that as you continue your negotiations, that you would please prioritize funding for compensation for direct care workers. They work so hard, and they care so much for the people with disabilities they serve. Minnesota has always been a compassionate and responsible state and has always heeded the call to care for the least among us. And I'm asking you to continue this tradition and support the direct care workers of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony, Ms. Ganella, and for your advocacy on behalf of your daughter and all Minnesotans. Ms. Krenke, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Mary Krenke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Given the size of the budget target for this committee, MHA is supportive of most of the provisions in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Bill. First, we are appreciative of the inclusion of Chair Dean's bill modernizing the hospital inpatient fee-for-service program. Second, as others have mentioned, MHA is very pleased that the House continues to prioritize mental health services and new funding for mental health services. There are several items in the bill, the mental health grants, the innovation grants, the school-linked mental health program, the Text for Life provision. There are a lot of really good mental health provisions in this bill, and we are very grateful for prioritization of those grants. There's also some additional funding for the physician residency expansion program. If we don't train our physicians here in Minnesota, we will lose our physicians. We need to do the training here. We don't attract physicians from other states very well, so we need to train our own. Regarding the savings taken in this bill, MHA is pleased that the House is opting to provide savings through payment model reforms rather than across-the-board provider rate cuts. The healthcare delivery system pilot projects at least give providers an opportunity to provide savings through better care coordination and working collaboratively with social services and with the federally qualified health centers to try and lower costs. The two items of concern that I do want to mention are the contingent provider rate reductions taken in the bill. We believe that the reforms that are in this bill will work, but we're afraid that they're going to take time and play out over time. So we're not quite sure with, like, the healthcare delivery system pilot projects, how quickly those savings will appear to the state and the timing of the contingent rate cuts as the backfill. So we would like to continue to work with the committee on that provision. And finally, I know you've heard our testimony before on this. We are opposed to the new quality reporting system that we believe will be duplicative to the state's and federal's quality reporting measures. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we hope to continue to work with you throughout this legislative process.
Thanks for your testimony, Ms. Krenke. Next up, we have Claire Sanford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope your dog hasn't eaten any socks lately, because I think I speak for everyone in the room when I say we really weren't in a good mood this time of year.
No, yeah. Murphy was just in over the weekend. He's sound as a pound.
Oh, good. My name is Claire Sanford, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association, which is an association of 250 child care center providers statewide. And I'd like to thank this committee for the inclusion of several items in this bill aimed at easing the regulatory burden on child care providers, providing exit interviews after a licensing visit. Fix-it tickets and amended correction orders will be a big step towards providers feeling respected as professionals. Allowing child care to be exempt from the positive supports rule will help ensure that children with developmental disabilities are not turned away from services because providers cannot meet the training and documentation requirements. These improvements are real, and they will help keep providers in our already stressed system. But they're only nibbling at the child care crisis. Providers, parents, and employers have appreciated the House's recent focus on child care. But it's disappointing to see all that good work, all those recommendations, and all those good bills result in nothing that will really address access and affordability, specifically the CCAP program. That was from the Department of Redundancy Department, because that was programmed twice, sorry. Bills to adopt new federal requirements for family-friendly eligibility policies and a provider rate increase had strong bipartisan support, and I thank the members at the table who worked to address these most pressing needs. Thank you, Rep. Branson, for your leadership. Thank you, Reps. Albright, Pinto, Backer, Hamilton, Liebling, all co-authors on some of these bills. We didn't ask for everything. You heard about the federal conformity for child care assistance earlier from the commissioner. We just asked for the provisions that will really bring relief to families. That's really our focus. If we want families to move off of assistance and lead successful lives, we need to structure programs to make that possible. That's what these reforms do, in addition to supporting healthy child development. I know we've got a little time left in session, so I just want to say, please be bold going forward and do something positive with CCAP. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next up, we have Jeff Bangsberg, Minnesota Disability Law Center, and Laura LaCroix on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am not with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I'm a citizen advocate here, and I do not receive any compensation from anybody here, from anybody to be here today in front of you. So
well, thank you for being here today. We're glad you came.
Okay, great. First, I'm speaking on behalf of House File 481, which deals with the complex care for PCA's issue, and that's for those individuals who require 10 or more hours of care in their homes per day in order for them to receive personal care assistance services. Many of those individuals with disabilities are employed and are paying taxes when they can get up and get out of bed and do so. People who are living at home are often with the most complex care needs are having the hardest time finding personal care assistance. Same pay, regardless of complexity of services needed, is something that has happened over a period of 48 years, and we need a differential in the PCA program. The PCA program overall is a great and cost-effective program, and I'm quite shocked and dismayed that not only was 481 not even considered in this particular bill, but there's no increases for any direct care staff or for any personal care assistants in the community. And only a month and a half ago, I heard the Legislative Auditor's Office report out to you all that the biggest crisis that the Home and Community-Based Care Services community faces is the fact that we don't have direct care staff that are available to help these individuals get up and out of bed and go and do things in the community. And the only reason why I actually came back this year, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is because last summer two of my friends died. They did not have the direct care staff in their homes. They did not have people to be able to get them up and get them out of bed. One person died in the hospital with sepsis, and the other person passed away. He was tired. He did not have weekend backup help. He did not have anybody to help him out whatsoever. I implore you to reconsider rate increases for people with direct care staffing needs. Thank you so much. I appreciate your consideration on these issues.
Thanks, Mr. Bangsberg, for your testimony and for your advocacy here at the Capitol. Next up, we have Laura LaCroix. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura LaCroix DeLune, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Coalition for Targeted Home Visiting. We appreciate the challenge you have before you putting this bill together and want to thank you for recognition for the MA reimbursement rate increase for targeted home visiting services and evidence-based programs. We hope we can go a step further and offer that to all public health nurse visits that take place across the state. In addition, as you negotiate the final bills, we're hoping that you will find resources for targeted home visiting grants to communities across the state. As outlined in House File 1784 by Representative Cresha, Pinto, Poston, and Fisher, we appreciate your support and think this will make an enormous, will have enormous benefit on our youngest citizens in Minnesota. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you so much for your testimony today. We do appreciate it. Next up, we have Mr. Daniel Yang and Santa Leff will be on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Daniel Yang, and I'm the coalition organizer for the Voices and Choices for Children Coalition. We're a cross-sector coalition of early childhood advocates and parents representing communities of color and American Indian communities across the state. Voices and Choices for Children focuses on developing strongly engaged cultural communities of learning, organizing, and advocacy for their input and impact in shaping more equitable practices and policies that will support better outcomes for children of color and American Indian children prenatal to 8 years old. Voices and Choices for Children's top legislative priority this session is focused on increased investments in the child care assistance program. Affordable, accessible child care helps advance opportunity for communities of color and American Indian communities. It's a two-generation approach for broader family economic security because it helps parents to work and children to succeed. More than half of Minnesota's increase in child poverty can be accounted for by the increase in black child poverty. In addition to the rising level of poverty for children of color in Minnesota, children of color disproportionately represent the majority of children enrolled in CCAP, more than 60%. To address these child care accessibility and affordability issues, the Voices and Choices for Children Coalition advocates for forecasting the CCAP basic sliding fee to ensure every eligible family can access it, including more than 5,000 families currently on the wait list, increasing the CCAP provider reimbursement rate to the 75th percentile to allow parents to access to identify child care that's culturally responsive, meets their needs, and is within their budgets, and improving our child care system and making it more family-friendly by implementing and funding the Child Care and Development Fund federal reauthorization provisions. Our coalition is deeply troubled that the House HHS omnibus bill does essentially nothing to address CCAP child care accessibility and affordability issues. Most concerning to the Voices and Choices for Children Coalition is that at a moment when our state has more than a $1.6 billion surplus, we refuse to invest in the communities facing the greatest disparities, communities of color, and our state's most vulnerable populations, children. If this isn't the moment to invest in our children's future, when will that be? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Senator Leff. Welcome to the committee, and Ann Milhetra on deck. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Senta Leff. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, and I'm also the co-chair of Homes for All. Homes for All is one of MCH's annual campaigns, and we represent over 170 private and public organizations statewide. And I'm here to say thank you to the committee for including a one-time increase of $3.25 million for the Homes for All request offered by Representative Hamilton. These increases support programs serving long-term homeless households, adults with serious and persistent mental illness, transitional housing, and emergency shelters. More than 9,000 individuals on any given night will be helped through these investments. We look forward to supporting the House's position as you move through the legislative process on this. I'm also here because I want to thank you, Representative Pearson, for your leadership on MFIP this year. Many of my members and the families they serve watched the hearing from about a week and a half ago and heard your commitment to getting the ball rolling on an increase that hasn't happened in more than 30 years. We know you took a risk by doing that, and we appreciate it. The committee seemed to have some broad agreement during that conversation that a COLA was not enough. I heard Representative Pearson say that, as did many others. What the committee seemed to lack agreement on was whether compromise or any kind of incremental change is acceptable for MFIP families. Many of the members I represent live in very rural communities around the state, and they can't be here to make their voices heard. Some of them are actually former TANF Innovation Fund grantees before the fund became a DHS planning and research fund. And they asked me to tell you that when you're a parent who tucks your kid into bed in the back seat of a car, a COLA would not have been nothing. Families from the Iron Range asked me to tell you what they would have purchased with the money Representative Pearson advocated for. They would have purchased bus tickets, they would have put gas in their car, they would have put clean diapers on their babies, they would have bought more milk when food stamps didn't stretch far enough, and they would have paid for some basic toiletry supplies like deodorant and baby wash. There's about $250 million a year that comes into the state of Minnesota every year from the federal government in the form of TANF. More than 85% of it goes to programs, counties, and state administration. Less than 15% of it goes directly to families. As an advocacy community, we have always said TANF money for TANF families. We hope that as the legislative session moves forward, you will consider Representative Pearson's amendment as a way to end 31 years of stagnancy. We won't give up on continuing to push for more substantial increases next year and the year after that, and we trust that you won't either. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Leff. Next up, we have Ann Meltzer.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Melchetter. I'm a registered nurse at Minnesota Security Hospital. I'm also representing Minnesota Nurses Association, state nurses. I'm here to express my concern today with Pretz's bill, specifically the lack of operating adjustment for our facility. We serve mentally ill and dangerous population. Without this operating adjustment, we're looking at the loss of approximately 51 positions, many of those being direct care. Nurses in particular, we're already facing a shortage. It's kind of a domino effect for us. We don't have the nurses. We work with dangerous individuals. The injury rates increase. We end up working lots of forced overtime, and burnout happens. So we end up losing a lot of nurses. In addition to that, our staffing proposal that did not get included with this address such things that keep nurses at other facilities, such as retention bonuses, signing bonuses, things of that nature. So that is Krista.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony today. Krista Gattel, patient advocate for DHS. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed. And we have Jeff Bauer on deck.
Thank you. My name is Krista Gettle, patient advocate within Forensic Services. I want to thank you for allowing me to come and share with you a few important facts that I'd like you to consider while you're going through negotiations with this bill. First and foremost, if our operating adjustments aren't supported, we will lose employees. We can't afford that anymore. This would have a direct negative impact on our ability to provide good treatment and to fulfill mandates that we have. In comparison to other like facilities, we have a ratio of 2-1, so 2 staff to 1 patient. In other facilities across the country, there's 3-1. It's a significant difference. To make Minnesota Security Hospital safer, a safer environment for not only patients but for staff, we need to have support for a phase 2 bonding so that new construction and remodeling can be completed. We need additional direct care staff, clinical staff to guide treatment, and additional staff to provide evening and weekend activities. And finally, financial support for more hands-on training for staff. I had come before this committee before and talked about how hands-on training is really important, and that would also assist with the safety and of our patients and staff. Number 4, the governor's proposal supports funds needed for recruitment and retention of staff. That's super important, so we ask that you take that into consideration when you're moving forward. If sufficient dollars are not added to the operations of Minnesota Security Hospital, we can expect more of the same. This means continued high rate of staff injuries, scrutiny by regulatory bodies, errors in care and treatment due to taxed staff, and overtime, which definitely costs way more than filling the positions. Thank you so much for your time and consideration of these.
Thank you so much for your testimony today. Mr. Bauer, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jeff Bauer. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs at the Family Partnership. I have a few different thank yous for the committee today. First of all, I want to thank you for including Representative Miller's safe harbor for sexually exploited youth provisions in this bill. This committee has done a lot of building over the last few years, and this is a great step forward, so thank you so much for that. That means a lot of youth around the state of Minnesota, particularly in greater Minnesota, will have safe shelter and services to heal from sexual exploitation, so thank you. My second thank you is for the safe harbor for all provisions that are in this bill. We've talked a lot about what about adult victims of sex trafficking. This is the first important step to build Minnesota's system for adult victims, and that's really important as well, so thank you for that. And I just want to end with a personal thank you. I know some of you or most of you will remember the young testifiers that we had in this committee, Simeona and Fawn, who had a really hard time testifying. It's hard to be at this table. But any number of you sent them little notes, talked to them afterwards, encouraged them. And I know for a fact that meant the world to them, so I want to thank you for your humanity in that case. And I also want to tell you I'm really excited to share this investment with them, because just imagine how powerful that is coming from where they came from, to be able to sit here in front of you and then be able to see on the spreadsheet that you listen to them and you're building something just for them. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bauer, Rachel Weirs, and then Michael Scandrett on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Hello. My name is Rachel Weirs. I am part of SRSEA at the Minnesota Security Hospital, which means I'm a teacher at that facility. I am here to urge you to increase the VHS operating budget. With no increase, we will need to reduce our staff, which we can't do anymore. I feel that if you could take time to visit any of our VHS facilities across the state, you would understand that the need is there. You are the eyes and ears of your constituents. The average citizen can drive down the road, see a pothole, and know what they need to do to get that thing fixed. You are their eyes and ears. You need to see these things so that you can have them fixed. An example I can share with you just from my perspective, within my department, when I first started there, we had 6 teachers. We are now down to 3. We have the same number of patients. We have the same workload that they had back then, and I have half the number of staff to do it. At what point can I say to you, no, I can't do this anymore without your help? We need you. We count on you to support us. And we understand that you have a tough job ahead of you, but we need you to see what we see. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today. We do appreciate it. Mr. Scandrett, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Scandrett. I'm with the Minnesota Healthcare Safety Net Coalition. I think as members know, our coalition represents the safety net providers who are the nonprofits who serve primarily low-income and uninsured patients. Just have a few points of appreciation expressed and then one very large concern. We do appreciate the author and the members' support for including in the bill some greater flexibility in the Integrated Health Partnership demonstration projects and kind of trying to make things work a little bit better for the patient populations that have the most complex barriers and challenges, including paying an upfront care coordination fee for the cost-effective services that are needed to reduce future costs. Also, thank you for the grant programs for improving dental access. My area of concern is really hearing all the other great things that are in the bill and also looking at the bottom line of the bill, and it gets to the heart of why there's so many items like this that are funded with such a decrease in total spending. And I guess reading the bill, I realize there's more than one way to get to a Medicaid block grant. And so I appreciate kind of the effort here and understand the real desire to try to limit spending, but the effect of the bill basically is to set a target for Medicaid spending and then force the healthcare reform projects to try to achieve that, and if not, the Department of Human Services to make the cuts in provider payments. I just don't think we can move that fast with reform. I don't think we can save that money, so we will get the provider cuts. They'll be coming down the road. And the other risk we have is that really these healthcare delivery service projects that will be a source of a major part of the changes of savings counted on in the bill will really only be possible for a small number of large integrated health systems. They're going to basically have the ability to become HMOs in order to take the capitated rate, and none of the patient protections and provider protections that we built up for managed care when we have such strong incentives to cut costs are there. So what we'd like to do is work with the author and the committee members to be sure that the kind of basic protections that are necessary, especially for the safety net community, which could end up kind of holding the bag as other things start to fall apart and people have nowhere else to go but to those providers that will take them regardless of their coverage or ability to pay for care. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scandrett. Next up, we have Juliana Keene and Tim Headley on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Juliana Keene. I work at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. For 150 years, LSS has provided services to people with disabilities, older adults, children, youth, and families. Our employees and volunteers provide services in all of Minnesota's 87 counties.
thank you for all your important work and for the opportunity to testify. I'd like to start with items impacting individuals with disabilities. Thank you for including reforms to consumer-directed community supports that will allow more individuals to direct their own lives, have more independence while saving the state money. We're also grateful for attention to DWRS, which over the long term will increase staffing and funding stability in disability services. There are a few items not included that would have helped more individuals with disabilities move toward independence. And if there's an opportunity, we'd like to see this included, these items included in the budget. First, the Best Life Alliance bill that was spoken about and needed wage increase for direct support professionals. The fact that there's no movement on the spend down, we'd really like to see that spend down come up a little bit. MSA housing assistance services and income support that wasn't included. This would bring savings to the state and increase the income for services, income and services for people with disabilities so they can live independently. Also, the HCBS incentive pool wasn't included. This funding would help transition disability services through an incentive outcome-based grant, assisting more people to live independently in their communities. Other items included in the bill that would really benefit a lot of people LSS serves include safe harbor for sexually exploited youth, which was just spoken about, funding for caregiver support programs, foster care reentry services for youth aged 18 to 21, as well as much-needed investments in housing services and mental health. Thank you again for your work on behalf of all Minnesotans.
Thank you for your testimony today. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hello, Mr. Chair, Chair members. I'm Tim Headley. I'm with ASME, Local 404 in St. Peter at the Minnesota Security Hospital. I'm here today to urge you to rethink the budget proposals in this bill. At first glance, although some grateful, looking at it further, if you consider the Minnesota Security Hospital, Moose Lake, St. Peter's Sex Offender Programs, Anoka, Wilmer, and other like facilities. First glance, this truly looks like, again, we're being asked to perform surgery with Band-Aids, especially when we're tasked with responsibilities that are considered morally and legally expected of and from Minnesota. Mr. Chair, committee, again, we're hoping that you can be on the side that are there to help support us, raise us up, and take a step forward in our future for a better treatment of our clients and those who provide that service, opposed to taking a huge step backwards and truly feeling held down with no readjustments, somewhat felt slapped in the face by this. Thank you for your time. Have a good day.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Ann Krisnick and Corey Vandenberg on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ann Krisnick. I'm Executive Director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, which is Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, and Muslims across the state, working to help make a better Minnesota, which I know is what all of you are doing too as well. Our faith communities constantly see the struggles that our poorest families face, and I'd like to address just two concerns, both arising out of the Minnesota Family Investment Program. The first is I want to thank Representative Hamilton and all of the authors on our bill to discourage or to eliminate the discouragement of marriage currently built into the program. Repeatedly, as we talked with faith leaders, we heard about people who said they would like to get married, but they couldn't because of the cliff that was created. And we certainly hope you'll consider including that in the final bill. Secondly, you've had a number of testifiers talk about the fact that there hasn't been an increase to the MFIP program in 31 years. Our leaders and members see people at emergency shelters asking for help with the most basic of needs, and I just ask, as you move forward, try to think of some way to help those for the lowest income Minnesotans. I want to just underscore that the majority of the people getting money under the MFIP program are children, and a significant number of those are very, very young. So please, we urge you to do anything you can. I want to thank Representative Pearson and our other supporters on that bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Dean and members of the committee. My name is Corey Vandenberg from the SEIU Healthcare Minnesota, as well as SEIU's Conservative Member Engagement Committee, and I'm a home care worker from Oak Grove. We are disappointed that the omnibus HHS bill does not include the provisions of the governor's budget that fund a rate increase for both home care workers covered by the SEIU contract and the traditional PCAs who would get the same rate increase. Obviously, with your budget target, it's hard to make investments. I want to remind you that because of the low wages and few benefits, it is nearly impossible to find qualified home care workers. Both parties recognize we are in a crisis. I'd like to thank large bipartisan group representatives who authored House File 2399 and 2286, the standalone bills, to fund and ratify our contract. That bill, which mirrors the provision in Governor Dayton's budget, invests $48 million with equal federal matching funds to increase wages and benefits for over 50,000 home care workers, including the 27,000 self-directed workers covered by the new SEIU contract. For those self-directed workers covered by our contract, the minimum wage will be $13 an hour. There is also an extra 10% rate increase for clients with complex care needs. A new voluntary online matching registry will make it easier for clients to find willing qualified workers in their area, and training opportunities expanded as paid time off accrues more quickly. Even though they are not covered by our contract, the bill also provides an equal rate increase for the traditional PCA program, where private agencies hire and supervise the worker for the client. Finally, no worker is or will be required to join SEIU or pay any fees to our union. Clients and responsible parties also maintain the right to direct their care, including hiring, supervising, and firing any caregiver. As you negotiate a final package with the governor and the Senate, please remember these tens of thousands of workers and the people they care for. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next we have Pat Wolf, welcome, and Danny Eckert on deck.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Brock Wolf. I am the President and CEO of Nexus. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of the funding for the children's mental health redesign provisions in your budget bill. Nexus is a large nonprofit provider of individualized mental health services for youth with emotional and behavioral issues, providing services through outpatient, home and community-based services, and residential treatment programs. Nexus is headquartered in Plymouth, Minnesota, and we have three residential facilities, one in Austin, Minnesota, Girard Academy, one in Onania, Mille Lacs Academy, and in Minnetonka, Nexus Glen Lake. We also have the largest private, we are the largest private provider of foster care in the state of Minnesota, and we serve kids from every county and from all over the state. Right now, what we've seen is more demand for services than we've ever experienced before. And we have waiting lists for most of our services, and there's just a tremendous outpouring of desperation for the types of services we offer. We thank you for your continued focus on improving and strengthening the state's mental health system, particularly for the youth and families who need these critical services to rehabilitate and reintegrate back into their communities. I want to thank you particularly for the foster care provisions that were put into this bill, as well as the other mental health services. It's really an outstanding job by all of you. We appreciate the thoughtful approach you and the Department of Human Services have taken in both the critical bridge funding for these programs, along with the proposed future redesign adolescent residential services. If the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services continues to move forward on the IMD exclusion, as we expect it will, it is critical that the legislature provides funding for the 2018 and 19 years to continue these critical services while the Department of Human Services and the provider community come up with new ways to redesign the committee. I'm very excited. I do think we have the opportunity to redesign this system a lot better, and this 2 years is going to give us a chance to get a more efficient, more effective system that will have better sustainable outcomes for kids. So thank you once again before you hit me at that stop sign.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed. Peter Whitecock is on deck, and then Josh Berg. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Danny Eckert, and I help represent the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, also known as MNAC. MNAC represents the 17 federally qualified health centers in Minnesota with 70 sites statewide, serving the medical, dental, and mental health care needs of 175,000 low-income Minnesotans annually. We support the inclusion of the dental service grants aimed at improving dental access for MA and Minnesota care enrollees, of which MNAC serves nearly 60,000 dental patients each year. We also support the increased investment in and support for integrated health partnerships, or IHPs, the Federally Qualified Health Center Urban Health Network, or FUN, is the third largest IHP in Minnesota and has produced significant savings for the state. We know IHPs are a great investment for Minnesota and are happy to see growing support for them. Thank you for both, including for both provisions. However, MNAC is concerned about the contingent rate reductions in Article 11, Section 2. Specifically, we are concerned about the potential that rate reductions will create a fixed Medicaid budget and strain the ability of community health centers and the safety net to adequately treat their patients. Further, we are disappointed that House File 711, authored by Representative McDonald, and House File 1269, authored by Representative Zerwas, were not included in the omnibus bill. We have worked with the authors, DHS, and this committee on both bills, which rebase our Medicaid rates from 2001, streamline our payment process with the MCOs and DHS, and secures our community health center appropriation. Mr. Chair and committee members, as you take the necessary next steps to consider what is best for Minnesota, we urge you to reconsider including House File 711 and House File 1269 in the omnibus bill as an opportunity to build upon the ongoing success that FQHCs have achieved for the health and well-being of thousands of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
All right. Mr. Whitehawk, Josh Berg on deck, and then Dave Renner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Peter Whitehawk, community organizer with Hunger Solutions Minnesota. I'll be very brief and just wanted to say and thank the committee for its support of food shelves and for including additional funding in this bill, including the diaper amendment. It will go to good use in allowing a lot of getting healthier food and diapers in the hands of many hardworking low-income Minnesotans throughout the state. We look forward to working with the committee as it goes to the conference. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Josh Berg. I'm the Director of Services for Accessible Space, Inc., a nonprofit providing low-income housing to individuals with disabilities and assisted living services in those buildings. Thank you for allowing me to testify here. I will just highlight a couple things. Thank you for including the language related to the study of the workforce and actually, you know, putting in a requirement of us providers to actually open up our books a bit and submit some data that will actually help drive reform and allow whoever to actually get something done. You know, Kurt and Rebecca said it beautifully of we need to stop listening or do more than listen and actually act and stop kicking the can. And I think there's a lot of us in this room that have been saying a lot of things over the past few weeks, and it gets frustrating to see a lot of you at different events supporting things, sitting in these committees saying you support things, and then no action actually being done. We expect that you do more than that, and we'll hear that the budget targets are the budget targets, but then we expect you to push back against leadership a bit and demand that you get what you need. And there's some of us that are sitting here that are ready to step into your shoes, and hopefully there's a bunch of us younger millennials with the idealistic views, such as myself, that want to actually get some change done. We do expect it, and it can be there, and there's support in this room. There's a lot of brilliantly smart people with a lot of energy and desire to make some real positive reforms, save the state money, and do some really cool things. So, you know, ask the questions, but then actually follow through on some of the stuff that you're saying, and we'll be here to support you along the way. One minor little thing that I found as I was reading through this again this morning, on line 279.27, there's no such thing as a Class A or Class F home care provider anymore. They're comprehensive or basic, so that'd be a very simple amendment to actually get something done to move the bus forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it. Dave Renner, MME. Next on deck, Angie Tice, March Dimes. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Renner. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I am Dave Renner, here testing on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association and our 10,000 physicians and physicians in training. As always with a bill of this scope and size, there are many pieces the MMA supports and others which we have concern. I will try to highlight a few of those. The MMA supports the increased funding for physician residency programs, as mentioned earlier, and other efforts you have to address the healthcare workforce shortages that we have, especially in rural parts of our state. These investments, we believe, are critical to ensure that all Minnesotans have continued access to care. Physicians also recognize the tremendous damage associated with the abuse of opioids that we've had a lot of discussion at in this this session, and we thank the authors for including some funding for some pilot programs designed to address opioid addictions and abuse. The grants will help fund these multi-specialty care teams to coordinate care and treat addiction. The OMA continues also to devote significant resources to furthering prescriber education on the appropriate use of opioids and trying to help reduce the crisis that we have. And finally, I want to also say that we appreciate the authors, that the authors have not used the Health Care Access Fund to help balance the state's general fund problems. With the uncertainty of health reform in Washington, D.C., and the pending repeal, we believe that leaving the Access Fund surplus intact is wise. We also have a few concerns that I would like to just quickly touch on. We, as mentioned by others, have concerns with the proposed contingency cuts also for the $204 million if some of the other reforms don't achieve the expected savings. The uncertainty of this cut alone is concerning, but any cut to reimbursement for physician services on what's already woefully inadequate will not, and many times don't even cover the cost of providing those services, we believe will put clinics in some very severe, difficult financial positions. MA reimburses less than Medicare and far below what commercial payers pay, and we really do have concerns about continued cuts will lead to further cost shifting, number one, and other concerns. And finally, I just wanted to mention that we are disappointed that Representative Dean's bill to align our Minnesota quality measurement is not included in the bill. This is something that had very little cost and would help remove administrative burdens for clinics of all sizes and to help ensure our quality efforts are focused. With that, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate working with you moving forward.
Thank you, Mr. Renner. Next up, we have Angie Tice, Mark Dimes, and then Sheila Kiskaden. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairman Dean and members of the committee. I am Angie Tice. I'm the Director of Advocacy and Government Affairs for the March of Dimes. I'm here today to thank you for the important work of budgeting for our great state and to call specific attention to the provisions for evidence-based home visiting programs. Founded in 1938, the mission of the March of Dimes is to improve the health of all women of childbearing age, infants, and children by preventing birth defects, premature birth, and infant mortality. As part of that mission, we support evidence-based home visiting programs which have shown significant improvements in maternal and child health. I know this committee has heard quite a bit about home visiting, but just as a reminder, home visiting programs match expectant parents with trained providers who work with them to improve developmental, educational, and health outcomes for young children. These programs help to ensure that mothers receive adequate prenatal care and to promote healthy behaviors such as smoking cessation and maintaining a healthy diet. Evidence-based programs have been shown to improve the lives of and futures of children by helping to reduce the risks of premature births, low birth weight infants, birth defects, and maternal and infant mortality. We would like to call attention to the need to increase funding for providing evidence-based home visiting programs, with the goal being to reach every corner of Minnesota with those valuable programs as requested in the governor's proposal. Highly effective family home visiting programs produce outcomes that the March of Dimes consider important investments in maternal and child health. The Nurse Family Partnership Program, for instance, found that every dollar spent on home visiting programs saves $2.88 on average, and up to $5.70 can be saved in high-risk populations. In the state of Minnesota, nearly 70,000 babies will be born each year, with nearly 1 in 10 of those babies being born prematurely or before 37 weeks, as much of Dimes defines. Not only does it make good fiscal sense to invest in home visiting programs, we owe it to the babies born in Minnesota every year and their families to ensure that they have the resources available to get a strong start. The March of Dimes strongly supports home visiting as an investment in better outcomes for parents and their children and will continue to work with the Minnesota Department of Health and home visiting stakeholders to improve the birth and health outcomes. Thank you, committee, and thank you, Shiloh.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kiskaden. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Members, my name is Sheila Kiskaden. I'm an Elmster County Commissioner. I am a member of the Health and Human Services Committee of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and for the last year, I've been leading an AMC advisory group on the Minnesota Eligibility Technology System, so you aren't going to be surprised at what I'm here to talk about today. But I would like to start out with the fact that there are many parts of your bill that we do support. For instance, all counties are really supportive of the safe harbor for sexually exploited youth. We think that you're moving in the right direction here. We have a policy position that supports the direction you're taking, and kudos to you for doing that. Kudos on the home visiting reimbursement rates that you are proposing as well. But I can't be here without talking about something that I think needs your attention, which is the fact that since 1960s, counties have been the group that does all of the eligibility determination for medical assistance on the state's behalf. And since the 1980s, we have been using the same technology system, which is a DOS system. And it's getting very hard to even find anyone who can make small changes to that DOS system. So we feel that if you want us to have a reliable system, one that is efficient, investment in that technology system needs to happen. I understand for some of the reasons, the political reasons, why you have been reluctant to make that investment now. But whatever you decide to do with MnSHARE, with platforms for the private marketplace, you are going to continue to rely on counties to do their eligibility. And please, we need the tools so that we can do it efficiently. Right now, you are transferring costs to your property taxpayers because we've had to hire staff to do workarounds because the system isn't reliable. And now as we move to periodic data match, which we think, we have no objection to that. We want to make sure that everybody who is determined to be eligible stays eligible and that our data is current. But if the technology system doesn't work, then we get a lot of false reports. We don't have the reliability we need. So we would just urge you, as the weeks go on, as you continue to have these conversations, as you look to the future, and everyone wants to have an efficient, reliable system for determining eligibility, you can't have that if we don't have the technology platforms that are reflective of modern capacity and that are easy to use, that allow changes without a lot of paper workarounds. And there's going to come a time you cannot avoid making that investment. We would hope that you would find a way to make that investment this year. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Commissioner Cascaden. Help is on the way.
Good.
So, welcome to the committee, Ms. Sizer. Mr. Sizer, please introduce yourself and proceed. Stephanie Radke on deck.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mark Sizer. I'm the Human Services Administrator for Stearns County, but I'm here representing today MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. I want to thank you for this opportunity to share a few thoughts on both the language and the funding presented in House File 495. First, MACSA would like to thank Chair Dean for including investments in mental health. MACSA supports continued state investment in the state's mental health system. We do appreciate the mental health innovation grants proposed as a small start in building out our state's mental health system. However, counties are picking up $24 million in cost shifts related to the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Facility. As a Human Services Administrator, I can give you an idea of how these cost shifts have affected local counties. In 2013, Stearns County's cost share for civil commitments was $443,000. Since the cost shift change in the last biennium, our 2016 costs climbed to $2.2 million. Max is pleased to see this small down payment, but we hope that moving forward, it is recognized that there are significant county dollars in this system and that the state must recognize the sizable investments needed to make a real difference. We do support your investments to expand school-linked mental health and first psychotic episode treatment as an early intervention strategy that we know works. And we support the funding for voice and text messaging services to help those struggling with mental health concerns get help. Finally, we would like to thank you for including funding for children's IMDs. MACSA wants to express our serious concern over the removal of inflation from medical assistance forecasting. The reality is that the pressures on our human services system are increasingly at odds with our state's economic realities. NACSA supports a budgeting process and approach to service delivery that includes full funding for our vulnerable populations, does not rely on shifting cost responsibilities among various stakeholders depending on the funding year, and allows lawmakers to fully examine the programmatic needs being placed on our system. Finally, we'd like to mention that Representative Albright introduced a bill this year that would create a group to examine our state's human services financing and develop a strategic plan for how we can work together to address the pressures on our human services system. Unfortunately, that bill did not get a hearing in this committee. We look forward to working with you in the coming months to develop a budget that reflects a state human services approach to best address the needs of all Minnesotans. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have Stephanie Radke, but I see Mr. Harder is here. Are you pinch hitting?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
We are glad you are. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Kelly Harder. I'm here on behalf of MICA counties as well as Dakota County. First off, thanks to all of you, and particularly the staff that get us to this point along the journey. First and foremost, I want to thank all of you. You know, what the good news is, we really appreciate your support for the ITV. And the opportunity as caseworkers to be able to leverage technology really to assist rural Minnesota as well as the metro counties to meet mandates and that use of technology. Along with that, we really appreciate language around the mental health innovative grants and working with the hospital association. We very much appreciated that opportunity. Look forward to working with the state and the hospital association sitting at the table together to make sure and ensure those public dollars are invested in the most impactful strategic way as the mental health authority, and we feel that's a real good alignment as well. I just want to thank all of you that went through this committee on behalf of Dakota County too, the support for the data practice modernization opportunities, and we're continuing to work and refine that. If we want to have an innovative, integrated way of providing better service with better impact, we have to make sure that bedrock of the work we do is also modernized, but in a way that really protects the integrity of individual data as well. I also want to thank you, and it was a last minute, but the Pathways to Prosperity language, which is really around a national innovative approach where a couple counties really want to be able to take some glass cake tops and put them over the top of some work that we could look for a greater innovative approach to make public dollar investments without added dollars. And if there's a time after the committee, after today, where there'd be an opportunity for myself to come back and we can do a deeper dive into what that would look like, I gladly will do that and we very much look forward to that as well. Finally, we very much look forward to continuing to work with you. For example, in Dakota County Child Protection, we thank you for the funding that was there last year that brought us back up to what funding had been in the past. But we continue to see about 100% increase in some out-of-home placement related to that. Counties are continuing to be pressured in those realities and keeping the fundamental basis of our children and families safe. And finally, there was one bill we'd really look forward if there's a possibility working with all of you on behalf of MICA and Blue Earth County and ourselves as well. It's a jail in-reach reentry program. Even believe it or not, the counties have even said we're willing to pay the 50% match. So it's a zero fiscal note to the state, would allow counties choice to provide case management to assure successful reintegration into the community. So we'll look forward to working with all of you. Thank you again for all of your work to get us to this point, and let us know how we can get help. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harder. Good to see you. Next up, we have Kelly Kossel, and then Dr. John Pryor, followed by Dr. Murray McAllister. Welcome to the committee.
One second,
Representative Murphy.
So, Mr. Chair, I know that we're trying to get through the testimony, and I know we're going to walk through the bill tomorrow. There are some provisions in the bill that weren't bills and weren't heard, and I want to, before we leave today, just talk through with you about if there will be room or if people want to testify in those new provisions tomorrow, because the bill just came out in the last day or so. Will there be space for that? If you have questions, once we start looking at those provisions that weren't bills and they didn't come through.
Sure. Representative Murphy, yeah, we had posted the bill. There's a few provisions that have not been heard. Most of them have, even those that have not, have had similar or same bills previously, and we would be able to address those tomorrow during the walkthrough, and then also questions through the DE. So if people want to testify on that, that would be fine.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Dean, and the committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this bill. Thank you for including HF 1182, the TEFRA parental fee bill. This is a true investment for many families around the state. Thank you for funding her at the 25% level to lower parental fees. A special thanks to Representative Ross Peterson and all the co-authors on this bill. We will, as parents, continue to tell our stories and educate our elected officials on TEFRA. I am a parent, and it means so much to me and all the parents who have advocated on behalf of TEFRA to help our children get the medically necessary therapies and community supports needed for living in the community. Each of our medically complex children is important as the next child. Thank you for making these children a priority and making them the most independent possible for adulthood. Thank you for letting them not just live in their community, but be part of their community. Thank you for the continued focus on this bill and funding. Much appreciated.
Thank you for your testimony today. Welcome. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon. I'm John Pryor. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me here today. I'm John Pryor, CEO of HCMC. And either through training programs or trauma and specialty care, HCMC reaches people in all 87 counties in Minnesota. For example, we participate in the training of more than half of Minnesota's physicians. We operate the Regional Poison Control Center, our state's only 24/7 emergency hyperbaric chamber, the largest of only two critical burn units in the upper Midwest, and we're the backbone of emergency disaster preparedness system in Minnesota. We're a national leader and partner to the state in implementing public program payment reform efforts such as our Integrated Health Partnership and Hennepin Health. Also unique to HCMC, and this is very important, is that our revenue mix is comprised of 73% government payer sources, 45% Medicaid alone, which is more than double that of any other Minnesota hospital. HCMC is a statewide safety net resource that's critical to Minnesota citizens, and we truly need your help today. You've heard from us this year that we're currently facing a financial challenge, and this will not be going away in the near future. HCMC experienced an operating loss of $21 million in 2016, and this is despite, by the way, our journey in lean management and eliminating waste in the system. And we therefore approach this legislative system with a couple of proposals that have very little cost to the State General Fund but have a great financial impact to HCMC. We are disappointed that neither of the proposals that would have helped HCMC deal with our ongoing financial crisis appear in the House bill, including eliminating the 1.56% hospital surcharge on our supplemental payments intended to help us due to our high Medicaid percentage, which we hope you can consider as this bill moves forward. There still is something, though, that you can do to help us in this bill today, because two of the intergovernmental transfers are required by the federal government to end, you could insert language directing DHS when and how to end them. It would help us if you would end the intergovernmental transfer 2, that's IGT2, on July 1st, 2017, and phase out the managed care intergovernmental transfer beginning on July 1st, 2018, at a rate of 10% per year until 2025. At that time, that IGT would end. By including the language, you would make it clear how this federal requirement would happen. So I want to thank you for considering this request for language being added to this bill. That would be helpful to HCMC. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Pryor. Thanks for coming today, and thanks for all your great work at HCMC.
Thank you.
All right. Dr. McAllister, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dr. Murray McAllister, and I'm the Clinical Director of Pain Services for Courage County Rehabilitation Institute, which is a division of Allina Health. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for including the chronic pain rehabilitation bundle pilot in your omnibus finance bill. I have a handout that I'd like to share with the committee, which is going around the room at this time. Article 7, Section 7, would permit Courage County Rehabilitation Institute to test a bundled payment arrangement with DHS, which is how other insurers pay for chronic pain rehabilitation. Chronic pain rehabilitation is an effective, viable tool in the opiate reduction toolbox. And as you are identifying policy strategies to address the dual epidemics of opiate addiction and opiate overdose, this is a tested, research-proven way to help people reduce their reliance on narcotic pain medications or opioid medications for their management of their pain. Chronic pain rehabilitation programs teach people with chronic pain how to cope and self-manage their pain so effectively that they no longer need opioid medications, and then they return to work or other job training activities. At Courage County Rehabilitation, these therapies are pursued on a daily basis, Monday through Friday, for 3 weeks in duration, which simulates a return-to-work strategy or schedule. As you can see from this handout, patients who have been completed our program at Courage County have observed an 83% reduction in opioid medication use for pain, a 76% reduction in hospitalizations for pain, and a 53% reduction in emergency room visits for pain, among other positive outcomes, including returning to work. Again, Article 7, Section 7 would enable us to test a bundled payment arrangement through medical assistance, which would open up access to our program for eligible enrollees. We thank the committee for their time and support of this legislation.
Thank you, Dr. McAllister. We appreciate your time today and for the handout. Next up, we have Jim Lee Palin, Minnesota Association Community Mental Health Programs, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jenny Palin. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We're the statewide association for 36 community-based mental health programs across the state, serving all who come to us regardless of their income, insurance status, or where they live. I echo many of the sentiments of the testifiers ahead of me. I understand and appreciate the budget target constraints that you had to work within and the tough decisions that you had to make. And so I'd like to start by thanking you for several pieces that you did to support mental health within Minnesota, including funding the Mental Health Innovation Grants to invest into the community mental health infrastructure and the continuum of care, funding children's residential mental health and IMDs, early intervention, Text for Life for the Crisis Hotline, school-linked mental health grants, and the clinical training expansion grants to include mental health professionals. I would also echo the concerns that many of the testifiers ahead of me had made around removing the inflator for medical assistance. And we have some initial concerns and more questions and would like to learn more about some of the health reforms that you are proposing in this bill. We look forward to learning more about those moving forward, including the healthcare delivery system demonstration projects. With that, we are also a little disappointed that a couple of our proposals did not make it into this round of the bill, including ensuring that some full payments within managed care make it back to the mental health providers who are providing the services, as well as expanding telemedicine access within mental health services. But with that, we look forward to partnering with you and the rest of the legislature as we move these and additional proposals forward as we work through the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Palin. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Sarah Levins. I represent the 14,000 members of AFSCME Council 65 who work in public and nonprofit sector in Greater Minnesota. Some of those 14,000 members are employees who work in home and community-based services. Thank you for allowing me to tell you their stories. I'm going to start by talking about the wages made in one of the developmental achievement centers we represent in northwestern Minnesota. We have a van driver who makes $10 an hour, a job trainer who makes $11.90 an hour, a job trainer who has worked for the Developmental Achievement Center for 35 years and makes $13.85 an hour. Those numbers are a bit abstract, so let me try to make them more real for you. The van driver makes $1,733 a month. If they have an $800 mortgage, pay $100 a month in property taxes, $200 in utilities and $300 for transportation, they have $333 a month for food, clothing, and medical bills, and everything else. $333 a month working full-time. The job trainer, who makes $11.90 an hour, makes $2,063 a month. And if they have the same bills as the van driver, they have $663 a month for food, clothing, medical bills, and everything else. I have no idea how these people make it. And if anyone wonders why you can't fill home and community-based service job openings, this is why. When I talked to these employees, one of them told me she and her children were living with her parents because she couldn't afford housing. Another employee told me that she worked 6 days a week, 5 days at the Developmental Achievement Center, and a 6 day at another facility. She testified that, or she told me that it is often typical in this area that her husband's work was seasonal. So when he's on layoff, they feed the kids first, and they only eat if there's food left over. When you think about this bill and home and community-based services in the next several weeks and months, please think about these folks working full-time and trying to make it.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Aaron Bowie and Carrie Thurlow. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Erin Bowie. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. You've heard us testify a lot in committee about the workforce challenges of long-term care. I'm sure many of you have heard from providers in our district about vacancy rates, the turnover rates, the lack of applicants. And that's why I want to thank you for including a number of initiatives targeted at addressing these issues. First, I'd like to thank you for including the expansion of the Proven Skilled Nursing Facility Scholarship Program. I'd like to thank you for including home care nurses and housing and services nurses in the Nurse Loan Forgiveness Program. And finally, I'd like to thank you for including the new Senior Care Workforce Innovation Grant Program. You know that there is not going to be one answer to this workforce challenge, but we think that the different approaches that you've taken in all these initiatives will help us to bring new people into the field and to keep them once they are there. And now I will turn it over to my imperative partner to talk about the elderly labor proposal, and I hope that you will give the initiative another look as this bill moves through the process. Thank you.
Welcome, Ms. Thurlow.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow with Leading Age of Minnesota, also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. In case you didn't pick it up, Ms. Bowie got to do all the thank yous, and I get to be the bad cop, I guess. we know you had a very difficult target to deal with, but in the category of we hope it gets better and hope we can continue to work with you, I want to renew our hope that down the line that elderly waiver reform proposal can be included in this bill that was brought forward by Representative Schumacher this year. This would improve the payment system for elderly waiver services, all elderly waiver services, including assisted living, adult day, in-home care, Meals on Wheels, and transportation. And as a reminder, we already serve 30,000 Minnesotans on this program annually. These are people who would otherwise qualify for a nursing home level of care, but we are serving them in a place that they call home, meeting their needs, and keeping them out of nursing homes, so overall saving the state some money. So as 60,000 Minnesotans turn 65 this year and each year until the year 2030, we really view this as not only improving the lives of seniors but preparing for that age wave, and look forward to working with you and the committee as this bill continues to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thurlow and Ms. Bowie. We appreciate you being here. Next up, we have Matt Flanders. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Flanders, and I'm the legislative specialist with Citizens Council for Health Freedom. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd like to thank the chair and members and staff for the hard work putting this bill forward. The February forecast states that growth in HHS, the second largest spending area, is responsible for 87% of total spending growth in fiscal year 2018 through 19. So thank you for the decreased spending shown in the spreadsheet. We support the exemption to Rule 101 for rural dentists and would like to also exempt all dentists and all physicians. Likewise, we support the Benson exemption to the hospital moratorium and would like the moratorium fully lifted to increase competition and decrease costs. We also support your enrollee verification that withholds 2%, and we support the legislative control retained over 1332 and 1115 waivers. We do support the repeal of MNsure, the bureaucracy and mandates in the 13 sections in 62B. However, the exchange infrastructure is being retained through the federally facilitated marketplace. For example, on line 254.26, the bill requires incorporation of 62V.055 public program eligibility, but does not appear to limit the website to public programs. It also still has the navigators, call center, and website, as well as user fee rate that does not exceed the federal platform user fee. So it appears Minnesotans will still be charged for the system, and that system is still hooked up to the ACA's Federal Data Services Hub, which connects Minnesota data systems in the IRS, DOJ, HHS, and SSA. We do not support the $4 million on line 315.32 for decreasing racial and ethnic disparities in infant mortality rates. MDH has received $2 million every year since 2005. That's $24 million without any accountability or specific requirements for use of these funds. In 2015, we thank Chair Dean for asking for an itemization of spending, and we would look forward to having a more clear itemization of that spending. We view this as an unaccountable slush fund for the department and would like that accountability required. We'd also like to see the definition of integrated health partnerships in the bill, and we're concerned that the IHP section continues data collection, including race, ethnicity, social, and economic factors. So thank you, Chair Dean, for your time and attention to these matters, and we look forward to working with you going forward.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Flanders. We appreciate it. Next up, we have Kate Zachary, Tony Spector, and Catherine Kmet on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kate Zachary-Pate, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work. And first, thank you to the committee for all of your work and for including the board's recommended change items in the bill. As you know, the board's core public safety mission is critically important, and very simply put, it is to keep Minnesotans safe through licensing, complaint resolution, and education. As the executive director, it's my responsibility to champion the board's budget proposal, and I'm before you today to respectfully request that you include the Board of Social Work's fee adjustment increase in House File 945. As you know, the board is entirely fee-supported, and this request has no impact whatsoever on the general fund. The demand for our services has increased dramatically due to unprecedented growth in both licensing and complaint resolution services, while our budget and our staffing has remained flat for a number of years. We've been discussing this fee adjustment and the increase with the professional associations for the last 2 years, and we are not aware of any opposition. It's the first time in 17 years that the board has proposed a fee increase, and we've actually reduced fees by 30% since 2009. Even with this proposed fee increase, the actual fees would still be lower than they were in the year 2000. The adjustment results in an increase of a range of, at the lowest, $1 increase per month up to a $3 increase per month over a 24-month renewal period. This fee adjustment and increase is really critical, and it's necessary for the board to avoid projected deficit spending, which will begin in FY18 and continue. We need the fee increase to support the change items that you've already included in this bill and to ensure sound future policy and fiscal strategies. We believe there will be a negative impact on the ability for the board to provide our core public safety services if we're not able to get this fee increase included in the bill. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have Tony Spector,
then Catherine Commit, then Ethan Vogel. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you. My name is Tony Spector, and I'm the Executive Director of the State EMS Regulatory Board. Strategic IT decisions spur efficiencies that enable government to be responsive to the needs of the public. It also allows agencies such as the EMSRB to more efficiently and effectively operationalize its mission to protect the public's health and safety. The EMSRB credentials nearly 30,000 individuals and entities, more than those credentialed by most of the other health-related licensing boards. Several years ago, Minute had provided the EMSRB with a new licensing system at no cost to the EMSRB. Last year, Minute took away our e-licensing system, thus requiring the EMSRB to seek and obtain a new system. Because Minute is unwilling to do so, the EMSRB now will be responsible for paying the ongoing hosting maintenance support of this system. Again, we credential nearly 30,000 individuals and entities. Until our system is up and running, I have staff processing thousands of paper applications to the exclusion of other important tasks. Unfortunately, this bill does not include the change item in the governor's budget that addresses this agency's important staffing needs. Likewise, this bill does not include the change item in the governor's budget that addresses funding increases in agency operations. But moreover, this bill does not include the change item in the governor's budget that addresses critical IT infrastructure needs. Please know that Minute's general costs continue to increase, and now the EMSRB will be responsible for the cost of hosting, maintenance, and support of the e-licensing system that in all reality is the agency's operational software, enabling the EMSRB to complete its critical tasks: licensing, certifications, investigations, complaint resolution, education program audit and approval, and accurately processing the Cooper Sams volunteer reimbursement. The EMSRB asks for your support for the change items in the governor's budget, especially the change item that addresses critical IT infrastructure. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and a special thank you to Representative Jeff Backer, who serves on our board, for his commitment to emergency medical services in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Spector. Next, we have Catherine Commit. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. This committee certainly had a very challenging target to achieve, and we appreciate all of your work on this bill to make it balance. With that said, I want to talk specifically about the language in Article 1, Section 36, relating to the 2% withhold for the eligibility verification. Eligibility verification is not a health plan's function, and it's a function that DHS, MNsure, and the counties typically perform, and it's never been a function that the health plans have been hired for or have done before. It's an expectation that we don't think we can meet, and as a result, we are opposed to that. I would just say that the withhold is already at 8%. There are existing withholds in place that amount to about 8% of all of the spending in the HHS, in PMAP and Minnesota Care. So this additional 2% withhold would increase it to 10%. And for some of my plans, it would be a very concerning and financially troubling withhold to have to incorporate. One of my plans, Hennepin Health, would have to use their property taxes to cash flow the withhold. And it's for some of these people, these populations, it would be nearly impossible to get an attestation. So we think it would be extremely resource intensive and costly with little benefit to the enrollee. Even with the current shifts and payment delays that the health plans have today, they still continue to pay claims and reimburse doctors and hospitals, pharmacies, et cetera. And when the payments are delayed or shifted, the plans use their reserves to cover these claims. These additional shifts and withholds will likely result in the rates not being actuarially sound. Finally, I just want to mention briefly the language in Article 1, I think it's Section 25, the Healthcare Delivery System Demonstration Project. We're really interested in learning more about that. It books quite a bit of savings at $145 million, and we'd like to understand that program more and and look forward to working with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Kmit. Next up, we have Ethan Vogel and then Joel Ulin. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ethan Vogel, legislative representative for AFSCME Council 5. So AFSCME Council 5 has serious concerns with this budget proposal. We do appreciate the inclusion of partial funding for the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Program in Willmar. However, we do believe that this committee can do a whole lot more. And we have a budget surplus in Minnesota, and we should be looking to make investments with that money and not looking for cuts. We should be making investments in safer workplaces at AMRTC in Anoka, at the Security Hospital in St. Peter, and at group homes all over the state. And nobody should go to their job and come home injured, but the injuries we're talking about are just crazy. I mean, we had a guy almost lose an eyeball. We've had multiple members of ours suffer traumatic brain injuries. And this is beyond the normal stuff, broken bones, broken jaws, and people eating through straws because they get hurt on the job. And then they come to you and they ask for help, and we get nothing. And this is frustrating. And the same goes for the investment, the operating adjustment in DHS. That's an investment we believe we should make, because we have made progress over the last couple of years, but if we don't get that operating adjustment, we're just going to be taking steps backwards, and we're going to be coming back here and repeating this whole process. If you give the department the operating adjustment, they'll be able to plan for and respond to future challenges. And finally, I have to mention the tremendous strain that the child protection system is under right now. Caseloads for child protection workers have skyrocketed, and the mandates have just piled on and on. And funding, although we did get some a couple years ago, and we thank you for that, it hasn't kept pace. And if you ask the child protection workers right now, they will tell you that kids are less safe than they were before the task force on child protection. The caseloads are just too high, and the workers do not have the time, and you've taken away a lot of the discretion that they used to have to focus on the families most in need of help, and they're forced to focus on families that don't necessarily need as much of their attention, but you've mandated them to. So we just appreciate your time and encourage you to reconsider some of these priorities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Vogel. We appreciate it. Joel Ulin, you care. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Ulin. I'm the Public Policy Director for UCARE. I wanted to, first of all, thank the committee for the inclusion of the zero-loss procurement language that has been worked on for the last couple of months here. This is certainly something that we are very supportive of. I believe there will be an amendment coming tomorrow that continues to work to refine this, and this continues to be a work in progress as we've continued to work with different stakeholders on this issue. I did want to raise a couple of concerns. Ms. Kmit did raise one of them, but as it relates to the verification of coverage for members, this is simply a function that our health plan has not had. As we get the data from the Department of Human Services or MNSHR or the counties, we assume that it has been verified before it reaches us. And so we do not have staff at this time that does this type of verification for this. And so this would require us to hire additional staff to be taking a look at these types of issues. Additionally, the withhold requirement that's tied onto this is also troubling to us, in part because I think with the data that we do receive from the department or the counties for MNSHR, often we find that the data that was sent to us is often incomplete. We do not always have accurate mailing addresses, and I realize that that is part of what the committee may be trying to address here, but as the receiver of the information, we just often don't have accurate information. There's oftentimes where phone numbers are not even filled in, and so it makes it very challenging for us to be in a position to have to do the verification. Having a 2% withhold tied to this also is troubling for us because it puts more money that we are not being paid in a timely way. And for our health plan, we may be uniquely situated, but we've had situations because of our mix of business where we've had to take out lines of credit simply to cash flow the last month of June for the last month of the state fiscal year because we have so much money that is being withheld by the state in different forms of payment delays or withholds. So as we look at that in combination with the additional $135 million of payment delay that the committee is proposing, that also creates some financial challenges for us. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Euland. We appreciate that. Next up, we have William Angel, President, North Star Chapter, AAST. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Dean and committee members. My name is Professor Angel, and I'm President of the North Star Chapter of the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists. And I'm here to ask you to consider striking the provision of this bill that calls for the repeal of the Minnesota Radon Licensing Act, which Commissioner Ellinger referred to. I also have letters of support from two different lung cancer advocacy groups, Cancer Survivors Against Radon, and Citizens for Radioactive Radon Reduction, that also support the Minnesota Radon Licensing Act. I lost a brother-in-law at 38 to lung cancer. He never smoked. The most likely reason for his death was radon in his home. I lost a 62-year-old mother-in-law to lung cancer, and she never smoked. And again, the most likely reason is radon in the home. The reason we need the Minnesota Radon Licensing Act is to tighten down on uncertified people using improper equipment to make radon measurements. It's a fundamental life, health, and safety decision people face. It's a decision people rest upon to make decisions whether to buy homes or not. We also need this licensing act to support standards in the radon mitigation that occurs in Minnesota homes. Again, I ask you for your support in striking the radon repeal section of this bill. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Angel. We do appreciate that. Is there anyone else in the audience who was not able to schedule testimony time ahead of time who would like to speak? Welcome to the committee. Come on down and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dean. My name is Louis Frigali, and I am owner of One Day Radon Mitigation, and I am also the Vice President of ARSP, the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists. I would like to attest to Commissioner Ellinger's testimony and also to Professor William Angel's testimony in support of radon licensing for mitigators and measurement professionals. I am a practitioner. I'm out there every day in people's homes mitigating radon, and I witness a lot of improper techniques, dangerous construction techniques, poor measurement, which adversely affects the citizens of Minnesota. We really need licensing to maintain these minimum standards of education for the radon professionals. In conclusion, I urge you to support licensure for radon professionals and to, how do you say it, in the omnibus bill, there's a line that says to repeal the Radon Licensure Act. I urge you to reject that line, please. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Frigali. We appreciate you being here today. Is there any other testifiers who would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Please step forward, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Hi. Thank you, Chairman. And my name is Steve Riker. I'm a resident of Prior Lake, Minnesota, and I own and operate Low Radon. It's a radon measurement and mitigation company. And I, too, stand here in opposition of the repeal of the Radon Licensing Act. Anyone who's familiar with the history of the act knows it went through two iterations before it passed last year with the support of the industry. It is now, it, I think it's really important to understand that the majority of us who are professionals in this industry do support licensing and do support the law that's in place now and do oppose the repeal. We have, as the treasurer and founder of the local chapter of ours, we have 35 paid licensed or certified professionals that are on our nationally recognized group who, in fact, support the licensing. There's just, I think, a minority of people who just generally don't like regulation who want this licensing to go away. With that, I will appreciate the opportunity to present to you today and, support removing the repeal act from the current omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reger. We appreciate your testimony today. Is there anybody else who'd like to testify on behalf of the bill? Page? No. All right. Please step forward, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed.
My name is Mary Hartland. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. And I want to thank Representative Nels Pearson for being the chief author of this bill 2 years ago and the chief author of this bill this year, and for the committee's bipartisan support of making investments statewide for the 20% of Minnesotans who have hearing loss and eliminate waiting lists for people that are deafblind, for providing equal access to communication services statewide, modernizing services in a way that's going to bring us forward with all of the policy changes and the investments. We really see a bright future for people with hearing loss in Minnesota. So thank you so much to staff and to all of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony today. We appreciate that. Anybody else? All right, seeing none, I think we'll close the public testimony on the omnibus bill. And thank all of the testifiers for being here and for working with staff to get that in. Apologize to limit the testimony, but obviously I see the need for that. So thank you for being patient with that. Tomorrow the intention is to do a very quick walkthrough of change items in the spreadsheet and bill, and then we will go through with the markup and amendments for tomorrow. So the intention would be to start promptly at 1 o'clock in this room and just to continue on until we're done with the bill. Is there any questions on that? All right. Seeing none, we'll see you tomorrow. We adjourn.